So really, did we have a crisis? Well, you know, I'd like to think that we could sit back, execute our well laid out plans and, you know, just watch all our countermeasures all unfold. But unfortunately, we did have a crisis. The press coverage was intense. I was relying on translations of Japanese into English. So that made interpretation of what was actually said just a little bit more interesting as well. We had an incredible volume of calls. I can't remember the exact numbers, but I think on the first day we had an excess of 16,000 calls. Call drop rates, I think, were hitting around the 20 to 30% mark on the first day. Management was incredibly concerned about those call drop rates because they didn't want a panic to arise. At the height of the call volumes, we had a request for $600 million of surrenders. You know, as you're aware, we also had the financial markets around the world in panic as well. So our solvency was in doubt because of the depressed values of the CMBS. Our cash was predicted to run out in a very short period of time. I note Northern Rock only had 5 days of cash before they had to access the wholesale markets. Fortunately, ours was more than 5 days. But can anybody sort of hazard a guess as to how much cash in terms of days we potentially had? Any volunteers? 20 business days, Ken? Yeah, we had 20 business days of cash. That's given that the crisis lasted much, much longer than 20 days, at the initial point, we thought that 20 days was fairly light. We also had another problem, that we had some products that had market value adjustments. Unfortunately, they were linked to the swap rates, and because of the credit default, the credit spreads, our assets were moving in different directions to the way that the market value adjustments were. So we had an additional problem. So what did we do? Well, in typical Japanese fashion, we had many, many meetings, which made for very, very long days. But everybody was required to be part of the team, you know, because in Japan, the entire board was responsible for everything. And so we all had to be a part of every decision, including myself on the call script, where I knew nothing about Japanese call scripts, but I had to be a part of that team. But that script was incredibly important for us because what it did was it helped to reduce the concern and reduce the amount of surrenders that we had. So very quickly, we were able to fine-tune the script so that our surrender volumes had decreased. So we were able to give some comfort to the people ringing up on the phone, and so they didn't all surrender, which was fabulous, because otherwise our projections from the initial days would not have lasted. So the scripts were developed and refined, and we also developed agency rescue packages as well. So because I think almost 30% of the business was through tied agency, and we needed those people to be on our side as well. I think that ended up costing us $100 million, those tied agency packages, but I hope it was worth it. But you don't know at the beginning whether it was or it wasn't. What did we do? Well, this is the financial side of it. We sold, on day one, we sold all of our Japanese equities except for relationship stocks. Thankfully, this was prior to the collapse of the Japanese stock market, so we were able to exit our Japanese equity position without significant loss. We liquidated as many assets as we could without incurring capital losses. This is prior to the rest of the market. I think we had about a week and a half after the AIG crisis before the markets froze. So we were very lucky. We ended up with $5 billion of cash through this liquidation exercise. We constantly monitored our cash levels, and that was, and I'm talking at the beginning, it was every half day, and later on we were able to relax back to once a day. We monitored call volumes, I think, hourly, to track the trend, to see whether we're getting some adverse publicity, to see whether we could, I guess, talk to the media again to see whether we could get them to print some positive articles. But it was difficult. We had initially, you know, we only did our valuations monthly, right? So as we were going through, we quickly realized that monthly wasn't nearly enough. So we had to get, you know, valuation feeds on a more frequent basis. I wanted daily, but I settled for weekly and evaluation of the exits on a daily basis. Some of my management team didn't think we should rush to sell our assets in that first week and a half. Thankfully, I persuaded them to sell in an accelerated fashion because they thought we should do it in a more orderly basis because, you know, cash in Japan basically earns zero. So anything that we sold was going to earn zero rate of return. Okay. And on a risk management perspective, during that crisis, we decided that we needed to spread our cash around. So we had $5 billion of cash, but our primary relationship was only with one bank. So just in case that bank went down, we started to spread our cash around. That bank was Citibank, that was our, and they had a lot of rumours about their potential collapse as well. What we didn't expect, now this was the part that really blew us away, and I guess this is the things that you don't know about. And we had a overdraft facility in place, which would have provided us 3 extra days of cash. But unfortunately, it was withdrawn before we could ever utilise it. And, you know, it wasn't legal. It definitely wasn't legal. We had a contractual right to utilise this facility, but they said it's gone. So what were we going to do? Take them to court? Wait a couple of months for it to be resolved? It was part of our liquidity action plan. And, you know, we were relying on it, but it was withdrawn before we could utilise it, and we just didn't anticipate that. The other thing that we didn't anticipate as a result of the crisis was that the changing of currency from US dollars to Japanese yen was considered a credit risk. And so we were restricted on how much foreign exchange that we could actually change every single day. Because we had a very large block of US dollar business that was withdrawing, and we needed to convert fairly large amounts of US dollars into Japanese yen because the customers were only allowed to get their money out in Japanese yen. We couldn't give it to them physically in dollars. So that created another, because we only had the one provider, we had to go and then establish relationships with the other banks in a very short space of time, and we had no negotiating power, we had nothing. We were in complete crisis mode. We just had to take whatever they would give us. And the third point on this slide was that other parts of the organisation, because when you sort of think about enterprise risk management, you only tend to look, I had only tended to look at the organisation that I was a part of and responsible for. But what had happened was that our UK office had engaged in securities lending. So they had lent out their securities to other people. And unfortunately, those people could return them and ask for cash back. Well, AIG, in their wisdom, had decided to take that cash, which they got from the securities lending, and invested in some very long-dated securities, some of which were completely illiquid in the marketplace. So they had this $2 billion of cash call that was hanging over the UK office's head. So I was trying to persuade our Japanese management team to part with some of our precious cash to provide a backstop for our UK office so that they wouldn't go down. Because if they sought regulatory protection, then I figured that we were next. We couldn't stop the wave. And the Federal Reserve Bank wasn't that keen to help. They said, as a completely last resort, but you guys have to sort it out. And so they were relying on the Japan office, which had $5 billion of cash, to provide the cash to the UK office. And I couldn't convince the Japan management team to give any of that cash up to help out our UK colleagues. And the other thing that really was tough for us was the slow resolution. Even though there were, you know, proclamations by accounting standards bodies and everything like that on the valuation of CMBS, the detail was lacking, and we really struggled to convince the regulators that we could indeed be solvent. So what didn't I expect? Well, I thought that we could be directive, you know, but we wanted to do everything the same way. So we had to follow the rules. Now, Peter will talk to you later about following the rules, and he'll give you some good insights into that. But unfortunately, we had to make new rules up, because we couldn't just break the rules that we had. We had to make new rules first before we could actually implement those. So that was really tough. So we had a lot of committee meetings to develop new rules so that we could then implement them. Japan had seen other life companies fail. So the management team knew that if they followed the rules, put Japan first, then their longevity would be, I guess, insured. And so they were very protective of the Japan FSA and making sure that they looked after their particular silo. And so, I couldn't really fault that argument. But from a risk from the larger entity perspective, it was very difficult to overcome. And the video we saw about the flight and everybody wanting to look after themselves, well, this was Japan management wanting to look after themselves. You know, for me, I could leave Japan and I could get a job in another country. For them, that was their home. They needed to work with the FSA. They'd been in the industry a very long time. They just needed to maintain their reputation and be seen to be doing absolutely the right thing. We had a lot of problems with Japan first mentality in head office, because the people in head office couldn't understand why people in Japan didn't want to help the UK office. And it got very confrontational. You know, we had people swearing on the phones. I just can't express in a nice way how much confrontation there was between the two offices. And I think that damage would probably never be repaired. The working relationship post-crisis would never be the same again. But everybody does what I believe they need to do to survive that particular moment, and it does do a lot of damage for the long-term health of the organisation. It was a very physical toll. I mean, we had staff that exited us during that time and went on stress leave during the crisis, and you know, we didn't see it coming. For those people. And you know, one of the lessons that I'll just mention now was that you have to send staff home when you can. So when there was that lull or the eye of the storm, you have to send them home immediately, because don't just wait for the next, you know, sort of wave of crisis to come upon you. You have to give them some physical rest. Let me just focus on what actually worked well. And it wasn't that we had a well laid out plan. In fact, I will mention that we didn't actually have a chief risk officer. A risk officer was appointed, I think, a month before the crisis. but they weren't even a direct report to the CEO. They'd found a job for a person who was working for me that I didn't like. And she wasn't doing her job properly, so they found her a job as the risk officer. What worked well was that we actually started selling before everybody else. And I think that was the only thing that really saved us. Because if we didn't start immediately, then we would have been in really hot water. Transport also worked well. Basically, we organised for the key staff, pick up in the morning and take home at night, because these people were just too tired to just, you know, do anything else other than get in a car, get driven to work continuously, go home, sleep, come back again the next day. My BlackBerry also worked very well, and I'm very thankful, but I've given it up now. Now that I'm a consultant, I've given up my BlackBerry, and I'm very happy about that. My team worked really, really well, and I'm very proud of them. And I also had interpreters. I had two full-time interpreters plus a part-time one, and they worked basically in shifts in order to translate enough of the material so that I could be an effective part of the management team. Because I was the only expat on the management team. The telephone scripts worked incredibly well, and if your company is thinking about crisis plans, I'd encourage you to think about developing scripts ahead of time because they're incredibly important. The other thing that worked really well in our favour was the exchange rates. At that particular time, the exchange rate wasn't favourable for the US dollars, so all these people that had US dollar products didn't really want to surrender their products. And had it been a little bit more favourable, I think we would have had a much worse position. The other thing that saved us was basically the market value adjustment that was not in our favour wasn't easily accessible, so they had to ring up and ask for their surrender value. So if it had been on the web, I think that we would have been in really hot water, because that, pricing inequity between our assets and the swap rates would have been completely evident, and people would have been surrendering straight away. So what didn't work? Well, sister company relationships didn't work. After the ARG crisis, it was basically said that ARG is going to be split up and sold in parts, and so it was every man, woman for themselves. And, you know, all these internal deals that we had done at supposedly arm's length, wow, they took a lot of effort to unwind, because you didn't want to be the first person to try to unwind something, because, you know, you'd be the one that have to compromise in order to unwind it, because we had to try to tell people that we had extricated ourselves from ARG in order to get the confidence back in Alico Japan. What also didn't work well for us was our single service provider. So we'd done everything right in order to maximise revenue, get the lowest cost provider. So we'd basically put every single egg in one basket. And it didn't work well for us, because during that crisis time, we needed multiple relationships, we needed multiple banking partners, we needed just multiple of everything. Because if we could only do $50 million a day with this bank and $50 million at this bank, we needed every one of those $50 million in order to be able to survive. And I think the last one and is about human behaviour. People were looking after a numero uno. And it was very tough to not... Oh, it was very easy, I guess, to score political points in that environment, to position themselves for life after the crisis. And so when you had to make a tough call and you weren't sure what the right answer should be, well, you sign it off. You know, you deal with the consequences. Like the agency rescue package, finding somebody that really wanted to sign it off, even though people knew it was, you know, the right thing to do, how much was it going to cost, you know, those kind of things. So people didn't want to be blamed. So there was, even in that committee process, there were people abstaining from voting. What would I do differently? I would identify a crisis team in advance. And I know that you've talked today about these war games, but I'd take it to basically identify the key people that I would put in a team should I have a crisis. Because that team was, you know, we could practice together, you know, sort of before the event. And so I'd strongly recommend identifying your people that you consider to be a crisis team. When I was CFO in Manulife Singapore, we identified our crisis team for our business resumption plans, and I think a similar exercise is worthwhile to do. The other thing that we really didn't consider was prepare for apparent failure. I know it sounds sacrilege to prepare for apparent failure, but had we thought about it more, we wouldn't have been so entwined with our parent. and we wouldn't have so many interrelationships like Spaghetti Junction that we had to unwind. And it really did cause us a lot of problems. So I think, you know, with independent directors on sub boards, you know, some element of preparing for parent failure is necessary. I talked about having all of our eggs in one basket, and the thing that I do differently is have primary and secondary service providers. And I'm not so sure that I heard today about these war game scenarios, whether you actually enact them out, like what they did on the in the plane, where they actually sort of tried to put smoke in the cabin and see how fast people could actually get out when there was smoke. But actually, like having an off-site meeting and presenting people with a set of facts and saying, guys, what are you going to do now? I think that would be a real eye-opener to some people, and you can tell me whether you actually do that kind of mock crisis. But after the crisis event, the thing that I would do that I didn't do would be to speak to spouses. We really asked an awful lot of our people during that time period, and, you know, getting those the support from spouses saying, look, their job is safe, they'll be paid, would really, I guess, calm people down. You know, I don't, because I'm sure they went home and said, is your job safe? You know, what we should do, you know. And really we needed their 100% devotion to the job during that time period. And as I said, the transport for the crisis team worked well, but we didn't arrange it for everybody. We were only, at that time, we really just focused on the senior executives. So I'd extend it all the way down to the people that actually did the work as well. And sending people home when you can. I tried to send people home, but the culture was too strong that they wanted to stay around until the boss left. And what kept me going? My family and desire not to be the CFO of an operation that had to seek regulatory protection. My reputation. So thank you for the opportunity to talk here.
We've just rejigged how we're going to do this. So the thing that I want to bring out is in Warwick's reflections on the way things worked and what didn't work, the thing that he would focus more on and actually really do differently and pay a lot of attention to is managing the people. So you've talked a bit about culture, you've talked a bit about how the people matter. I don't know how much of your contingency planning actually takes into account really what you're asking of people in a crisis and how you're going to look after the people. One of the things to think about in a crisis is that it's a situation where your standard operating procedures, your systems and your manuals and everything that you know just doesn't apply. And what happens when what we know doesn't apply is that we start to feel very shaky and we get really scared. And that's when you really do need leadership. And how people behave in a crisis can be all sorts of different ways, from the extremely functional to the extremely dysfunctional. And that's where leadership really does come in, and Peter's going to say something about that.
Well, thanks, Colleen. We're on the home stretch now. Now, this story I'm going to tell you is based on an actual event. Some of the bits have been changed a little for reasons that will become obvious to you, but basically this is more or less what happened. I wanted to tell you about it because it was a turning point for me in my understanding of what leadership was all about, and indeed is the basis of what I, or the foundation of what I based my leadership on afterwards. It's an example of what happens when the rules no longer work. No matter how much planning we'd done, how much training, how many models we had, we got to a point where none of that applied anymore, and this is what happened. So to pick up the subtitle from earlier, this is when the black swan actually becomes the war story. So this is my war story. It's drawn from my time commanding a British nuclear submarine during the Cold War. And I'd just like to set the scene by giving you some of the regulatory environment that we operated in. Now, this is this was significant because when the Ministry of Defence told the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority that it intended to operate nuclear submarines to maintain and support the nuclear deterrent, the only thing that came into the mind of those regulators was that this was going to be a bunch of cowboys in naval uniforms driving mobile nuclear reactors around the coast. And they weren't particularly keen on that idea, and I guess we would have some sympathy with that. Now, UKAEA had quite rightly total control over the rules and regulations for operating nuclear power plants in UK and for the control of radioactive material. The risks were obvious. We'd seen things in other countries go wrong, and the UK was very cautious about this move to operate mobile nuclear reactors. So we were in a highly regulated environment. Every conceivable eventuality was covered by a policy, by procedures, by action groups that were set up, and by very prescriptive actions that governed what a commanding officer could do with his submarine. In order to maintain a certificate to operate, I had to put the crew through constant training, through an ongoing set of tests and assessments. External assessing teams would come on board, sometimes at no notice, and examine all of us, from me to the junior chef. Not that there's anything wrong with chefs. Perhaps I should have said from the junior chef to me. And even a partial failure might well prevent the submarine from sailing. And it might even prevent it from firing up its reactor, having the reactor go critical. And these decisions, when this happened to a submarine, they went right up to the top, right up to Maggie Thatcher, for a decision on whether the submarine would sail, notwithstanding the fact that UKAEA had said, we're not happy with it. So it was big stuff. Now, what this generated, as you can probably imagine, I don't know if any of you have worked in this sort of regulatory environment, but what it generates is a very risk-averse approach to everything. Nothing was taken for chance, taken by chance. Every new incident generated a whole raft of new regulations. Nothing was ever taken away, of course. So this mass of books just grew and grew in the submarine, and we were all supposed to know everything about it. There was no space for creativity, no space for initiative, and this didn't sit too well with the very necessary initiative that a submarine CEO has to have if you go out and start doing the real stuff at sea. So there was some tension in this. Certainly when you tried to apply, or when I tried to apply, that regulatory framework to the tactical environment. Okay. Now, just to help you understand why this was a crisis, I just need to give you a quick lesson on how a submarine works. So hopefully this will be a bit of light relief. And we'll go through it pretty quickly. Keeping a submarine in balance underwater is a bit of a balancing act. On the one hand, you've got the weight of the submarine. On the other side, of course, you've got the buoyancy of the submarine. Now, those two things need to be in balance. If they're not in balance, the submarine will start going up or it'll start going down. And the tricky thing with a submarine is that when it's in the water in balance, if you push it 1 centimetre deeper, it compresses a little bit, displaces less water, and accelerates downwards. And obviously the reverse is true. So it's a stable equilibrium. It's a real nuisance. but to help us, of course, we have thrust from the propeller, which also compensates for drag. Now, submarines spend a lot of their time at periscope depth, and they do that because they can collect information electromagnetically, electro-optically, and also, of course, they can see what's going on around them. And submariners feel pretty safe when they can see what's going on around them. So when you want to change depth, you'll notice on this not very sophisticated slide that the hydroplanes have changed angle. They're now sort of angling to make the submarine dive. And indeed, that is how the submarine changes depth. It doesn't go bodily up and down by making itself heavier or lighter. It actually flies effectively through the water in the same way as an aircraft does. Now, when you get down to the depths and start doing whatever it is you're going to do down there, you try and get into perfect trim. Now, bearing in mind that this is astable, so if you change depth, you stuff it up. But that ideally is what happens. Invariably, however, the submarine's not in perfect trim. It's usually too heavy. Sometimes it's too light. Heavy is better for us because the last thing we want to do is uncontrollably arrive on the surface. Whereas we've got a bit of depth to cope with if something goes wrong in that direction. So we tend to make ourselves a little bit heavy. Now, this is fine. And we go along pointing upwards a little bit, just a couple of degrees, just to keep ourselves on depth. However, when there's no more thrust, when this flying effect won't work anymore, this is the sort of effect we get from the submarine. So in other words, we need the thrust to allow us to stay on depth. And all the procedures and drills in the submarine are designed, and indeed the design philosophy is such that you can't lose thrust on the submarine. You've always got to be able to propel the submarine. And there's backup systems and secondary systems and alternative systems. And if all that fails, there's a battery and an electric motor. So there's lots of things you can do to keep you on depth. Now, in this situation, we were on patrol in an area called the marginal ice zone, so a bit of ice floating around on the top, which is good because it makes a bit of noise and hides our presence. And we were observing what some other guys were doing, and we had to go through we had to go through a routine nuclear reactor event. Zero risk. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been allowed to do it. We'd done it hundreds of times before in an operational environment. On this occasion, a very experienced operator made a mistake and shut down the reactor. Now, the reactor can be shut down in two different ways. One is a sort of partial shutdown, which is a safety shutdown with just a few of the control rods so that you can get them out again quickly and get going. It takes about half an hour. It's not usually a problem. And that's what happened. So immediately we went into an emergency recovery to get the reactor back working. Unfortunately, two completely unrelated events caused the officer of the watch, a 25-year-old lieutenant in the control room, to open the throttles. And he did that exactly at the time that the reactor was shutting down. So what that did was cooled the reactor core very significantly, which is a highly dangerous situation because cold water is very reactive. The reactor safety system therefore said this is not good, and it shut itself down completely. So all the rods straight into the bottom of the boat, and the sort of thing you only do when you get back into harbour. So we were in a pretty grim state. We had this reactor problem, an association of three unrelated issues. The submarine was heavy, because they always are. We were pumping water out as fast as we could to try and make it light. And we were drifting downwards. Now, the crew had done, and that's how we ended up, that sort of attitude. And by this time, we drifted under a bit of ice as well. So we were sitting there, the scale's not right here, but we're sitting there, moving slowly down towards the bottom, knowing that surfacing was not an option. Now, surfacing is always the last resort for a submarine, particularly in hostile waters, but, you know, if it's going to save your life, you'd probably give it a shot. But we couldn't do that because we had ice up there. So at this stage, about 2 hours into the emergency, the crew had been fantastic. They were doing stuff that we had never rehearsed. We'd rehearsed it in different bits, but we'd never put it together in this way because this was never going to happen. But they were doing all this stuff, operating their gauges, coming up with innovative solutions. Some of them were doing stuff without referring to me and getting it right and keeping the submarine more or less under control. They'd shut down all the machinery in the submarine to conserve power and so that we had power for the pumps to keep pumping the water. A nuclear submarine has a very small battery, so we couldn't really use that to go anywhere useful. And we wanted to keep it just in case we had to try and surface right at the end. All the heaters were off. It was getting really cold in the submarine. There was a sort of heavy mist, oil-laden mist in the boat because all the air conditioning and filters had gone off. There had been a lot of shouting, a lot of orders given, a lot of quick responses, and it had gone well. I was really proud of them. The commanding officer has a chair in the control room, and I was sitting in that chair. And I've been glancing at the depth gauge for obvious reasons. And my eyes sort of must have just settled on it, and I gazed at it really while I was thinking what was going to happen next and what was the worst thing that could happen now and how was I going to get ahead of the curve and start thinking about that, when I suddenly became aware that there were 20 pairs of eyes looking at me. And as I looked around the control room, in the sort of dim emergency lighting with all this sort of oil and oil-laden atmosphere, everyone had stopped what they were doing and turned and looked at me. Some of them still had their hands on their panels as if they expected some executive command to tell them what to do. But there were these 22 pairs of eyes. And at that point, I thought, oh, what's all this about? What do they want from me? I mean, these guys were experienced submariners, some of them much more experienced than I. They had all the technical expertise. They'd done really well. There was nothing, surely they knew, there was nothing I could say, no orders to be given that would help the situation. But they were looking at me. So what did they want? Well, of course, they wanted leadership. And my reflection is that I was lucky to have this awakening as a young leader in such a stark black and white environment where it was blindingly obvious, albeit in retrospect, that what they wanted was leadership. But I would suggest that we all have this all the time. We all have, perhaps not 20 pairs of eyes, but we all have pairs of eyes looking at us as leaders, people looking at us saying, I want leadership from you. And we better recognize that. It was easy for me to recognize it because of this situation. It's much more difficult, I would suggest, for you guys to recognize it because you don't have that sort of polarization that I've talked about here. So, let's just summarize through here. We'd done everything we could. Everyone had acted perfectly. There was nothing I could do to improve our chances of survival. And the crew needed something from me. And that's something I'm suggesting was leadership. So what did I learn from this? Well, I guess two things mainly. The first is that it doesn't matter how hard you plan, how clever you are, how good your maths is, how tremendous your assessing processes are, how good your regulatory environment is, sooner or later something will go wrong. It's almost by definition. There will be a crisis when you're suddenly in new territory. So, by all means, yes, we must plan for these things. We must be as clever as we can be about predicting these risks. But also, we should prepare for what happens when they don't work, when the rules don't work. So that was the first thing that I learned. There will always be something that goes wrong. It's almost human nature. We will make sure there is. And the second thing is that leadership is an act from start to finish. It's got to be an authentic act, but be in no doubt it's an act from start to finish. Because when people want leadership, they want a certain type of leadership in a certain way, in a certain time frame. And a good leader had better be able to give it to them. It may be that two different situations require a completely different sort of leadership, but the really authentic leader who really understands what leadership is about also understands that it's an act. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm not going to be telling you anything new. I reckon that most of what I'm going to be saying you've heard all before. What I aim to do is put it together for you in a way that you may not have had it put together before, and to stimulate your thinking. So what I know about is people and how they behave in organisations. Yes, bring those down. And I don't know anything about speaking using a microphone because it's not what I do. Okay. So we've heard something about how people behave in a crisis, that some people rise to the occasion. A small group of people thrive on a crisis, and when there isn't a crisis, they'll manufacture one. And Peter has lots of stories about people that he wanted to be around him in a crisis, but they were just impossible to live with when there wasn't one. There's a very, very rare subgroup of people who are actually able to operate in both crisis and non-crisis situations. Some people totally fragment. They go to ground, they go to water, they can't cope. They just disappear. Some people will look out for number one. It's in Warwick's stories. You know, I don't care about you, I just care about me. Okay, it's actually more useful to you to think about how do you create an organisation or a system that takes into account that some people are going to be dysfunctional, that some people are going to look after number one, and that some people are actually going to come to the fore, people who you might least have, whom you might least have expected this. And again, this is about leadership. And it's about the organisational culture. Now, I'm going to use culture and system and context interchangeably. They're subtly different, but it actually doesn't matter for the purposes of this conversation here. Okay. And a lot of you have talked about an enterprise risk management culture. And this is a subset, if you like, of the wider organisational culture. It's how you do business. The behaviour and the culture are absolutely critical to how you do business. If operational risk is how you run your business and what falls between the cracks, then you will never manage your enterprise risk any better than you manage your operational risk. Yeah? I mean, this is what a systems view of human relations tells us. If you can get your organisational culture right, then you've got it sorted. Okay. So perhaps another way of talking about operational risk or cultural risk is leadership risk. Because one of the things that I'd like you to think about is that the CEO's main job, the main job of the leader, is to drive a good organisational culture. Yeah? Because as a leader, there's no way on this earth you have all the information and all the skills to do the job that needs to be done. And your expert power is nowhere near good enough to actually get people to come along board with you. Your job is to create the teams and to create the situations where people will actually do what is required and do more than what is required. And leadership is something that happens at all levels of the organisation. Yeah? It's not just the CEO's job. It's not just the job of the direct reports of the CEO. It's every single person. It's about your own personal authority, about what you take up, about what you know and what you don't know. All right. And in a crisis, the more an issue matters, the less likely you are to actually be on your best behaviour. You know, it's impossible to think cogently and clearly in a crisis. Somebody talked about the amygdala, part of the limbic system. It's the old fight or flight that we heard about earlier. Now, the more you know about yourself and how you behave under conditions of a maximum uncertainty, you know, what pushes your buttons, and it's going to be very different from what pushes my buttons, the more able you are to exert leadership when it really matters. And things actually go south 50 times a day. It isn't just in a crisis, you know, when the word crisis is writ large, that people want to fight or they want to flee. It's, you know, any time something actually happens to make you even a tad alarmed, There's something like 10 billion units of data that we get hit with daily. We process something like 150 of those. At the end of the day, we retain maybe something like 5 to 7 of those. We're continually looking for stuff to eliminate and filter out, because otherwise life is too hard. Life is unmanageable. How do you know that what you're filtering out is not of vital importance? Now, the more self-aware you are, the more able you are to actually behave well in the crisis. Now, I don't believe in reinventing the wheel. So what I've done, this is an unmash of some of the slides that Mark used in last year's ERM. Yeah? Now, you've talked about the organisational culture being really important. Now, organisations that did well. Firms that did well had good management oversight. They actually had good organisational culture. You've talked about a rich dialogue. Yeah? It's about people being able to have the straight conversations without ducking and diving. Yeah? It's about people actually being willing to say to somebody else, hey, I've got some bad news. If you have a good organisational culture, you can tolerate that. If you have a poor organisational culture, then what happens is that, don't go and bother me with your problems. I've got my own problems here. I don't want to know. And by the way, what do you mean? You just lost $100 million. Well, that was an idiotic thing to do. Go and fix it. So the next time I do that, and I'm not going to tell you. And maybe I'll fix it and maybe I won't fix it. And maybe you'll notice when it, heads up to a billion. And how many times do we know about that that's happened? It's not uncommon. So the culture, you get liquidity management, you get risk management and stress testing when people actually know that it's okay to have these conversations about stuff that normally ends up in the too hard basket. Yeah. And again, this came from one of Mark's slides last year. And I want you to look at, where the single most important criteria of whether or not you're actually able to manage your risk effectively and to manage your enterprise risk is the organisational culture. This is all about operational risk. An operational risk goes through the whole of your organisation. What you're looking at, if you're looking at culture here, is that you actually need to create a culture of challenging and questioning by all employees. Now, there's a wonderful apocryphal story, told, I don't know if it's apocryphal or if it's real, told by Thomas Watson before the organisation that he founded actually became IBM. And he had an accountant who did something and lost $4 million. Now, in the 1930s or 40s, it's not inconsequential now, but in those days it was a huge amount. And he offered to resign. And Thomas Watson said, don't be mad, I've just spent $4 million training you. And so it's that attitude to, learning. It's okay to make a mistake. It's not okay to not learn from it. The culture of no blame. It's absolutely critical. And we have lots of ways, lots of very subtle and very powerful ways of blaming people. A lot of the time we don't even notice when we're blaming somebody. But the impact of that is that people shut down. And they don't actually tell us the bad news. And what you're talking about is, if you're going to break down the silos, what you're talking about is actually opening up the system. Now, when you have an open system where there's communication across all levels and people can actually go and talk to whoever they need to talk to without worrying about proper channels, when you have an organisation where you can actually go say to somebody, what you're doing right now doesn't work. When you have an organisation where people are actually listening to each other, we have an organisation with very permeable boundaries. Then you have what's called an open system. Yeah? A lot of interchange with a lot of other with its environment. Now, leadership and learning is an emergent property of an open system. The more you open up the system, the more you allow, you create the conditions where leadership and learning are possible. In a closed system, it's all too scary to let new ideas in, to let new thoughts in, to actually even listen to what somebody else is going to say, to let the bad news in. And we all have, within as individuals and as groups, different, I guess, aspects of being open and different aspects of being closed. Okay. So again, Mark talked about this as managing the underlying causes for risk culture failure. You know, this is nothing less than how you would ordinarily develop your talent, identify and foster talent. It's proper good management practice. If you're not doing it, how on earth are you actually creating a sustainable organisation? Where is the next generation of talent going to come from? Who are they going to learn from? If that's not what gets done. Okay, so that's enough about culture. I want to say something about the sort of leader and why leadership is so important. Certainly in this 21st century, it's not enough just to be a good manager. I mean, Peter talks about leadership being an act from start to finish. It is an act from start to finish in both senses of the word. Yeah? It's an act. It's a set of it's something that we assume, but it's also a set of behaviours. And it's the behaviours that are really important. And it's the behaviours from the inside out. Yeah? It's not something that you can pretend. It's a role that you've actually got to inhabit. Otherwise, you have no credibility and people are not going to follow you into uncharted waters. So the personal and the professional are very, very closely braided. Yeah? And the thing that allows leadership to happen is the conversations that you have along the way. So leadership is the art of causing others to want to collaborate. It's relational. It's independent of temperament and personality. And it's a capacity. It's something that you can learn. Anybody who says leadership... Sorry, I didn't mean to do that, but I'll get there. Anybody who says leaders are innate and they're born is actually wanting a way to avoid doing the hard work of thinking about their own failings or thinking about other people's failings and addressing those. So as a leader, you're having conversations that impact others all the time. You're always on, in the same way that you can't not communicate. You know? Even when you don't open your mouth, you're actually giving a message. And you need to be aware of what that message is, because otherwise people are going to take, you know, each person getting the message is going to take something different from it. It may not be what you want them to know. It may not be what you want them to take away. Right. And you create the culture, whatever that culture is, one conversation at a time. When you put... Now I'm onto this slide. When you put a bunch of people together on one set of criteria, like their skills and their capacity to do a particular job, there's a whole lot of other stuff that comes along for the ride. Yeah, people's ideas about how the world works, people's temperaments, people's personalities, people's past histories, people's beliefs, people's emotional set, people's values. And that stuff is there in the room. How many of you have been in a meeting discussing one thing and you thought to yourself, there's another conversation happening here and I actually don't know what it is and I can't keep track of it, but it seems to have nothing to do with what we're here having a conversation about? Yeah? So there's an elephant in the room. Probably the whole zoo is in the room. And it's not being named. It's not being addressed. And it actually gets in the way of... It gets in the way of any sort of good culture. You've always got this stuff that sits below the iceberg. You know, the shadow conversation, the shadow system. And it makes... If you think about what is the lid on the team's capacity to fulfil on its goals, you know, what drags you down? How come you set goals and set aims and don't get there? You know, it's this stuff that sits below the iceberg. Yeah? if you ask people a set of questions, I mean, you have an organisational diagram. Yeah, you have what is called the formal organisation. Now, if you ask people a set of questions about, well, who would you go to who would you trust in your organisation to get information about what's going on in the company? Who do I trust in this organisation to actually go and talk about a difficulty I'm having with a colleague to? Who do I actually trust in this organisation to go talk to about, I have something that I don't, you know, my boss is actually driving me nuts. Who do I trust in this organisation to actually talk to about whether I'm on the way out? Who do I trust in this organisation about to go talk to about a personal matter that's really, really personal and really I need to start talking to people in the organisation, but I haven't yet? When you ask that list of questions for a whole lot of people in the organisation, you get, if you like, a map of the informal organisation. You know, the networks that people trust, that people actually relate to and, you know, where they go. Now, if there's the wider the gap is between, if you like, the informal organisation, who people trust and where their relationships are, and the formal organisation, then the less health there is in that system. I mean, if I have a problem with my boss and I actually can't go talk to my boss about it, you know, what does that say about the relationship there? So there's a whole lot of stuff that happens down in the shadow system that needs to be a part of the conversation. You know, the more you pretend that this other stuff going on in the organisation is not happening, the more ill health creeps into the organisation. And here's how it happens. Think about... I didn't even notice. Okay, so if you think about a bowl of fruit and you have a crack in the bowl and the fruit goes bad. Yeah? Now, you may not notice that there's a crack in the bowl because it's somewhere where you're not looking, but you notice the fruit going bad and so you replace the fruit. The fruit's going to continue to go bad because you actually haven't fixed the crack. Think about the bowl as the culture or the context, the container within which your people operate. Think about the fruit as being the people. Most people want to do the right thing. The thing that makes the difference when times are tough is the quality of the leadership, the quality of the culture. Does the culture support people behaving well even when it's scary? Or is there a blame culture and silos that says, well, actually, it's easier not to say anything at all? Yeah? How many of you work in organisations where there's a published set of values? How many of you have watched as something has happened in the organisation and you thought, I don't know if that actually fits with what we say we're on about, and nobody's said anything? Yeah? So one conversation at a time, the rot sets in. And that's how the shadow system gets created and how it gets maintained. And a lot of the time we don't even notice that we're walking past stuff. We don't even notice that what we're creating is a negative culture. But really, what's happening is that I'm talking to you with all of my assumptions and all of my history and all of my experiences and all of my meanings and all of the distractions that are there. And I'm talking to you who has your own set of mental models about how the world works. And we talk from the bottom of our iceberg to the visible part of someone else's. And they respond from the bottom of their iceberg to the visible part of ours. Sometimes we're totally unaware of all the things that are in our response. And nonetheless, they have an impact. And the impact that we have on others is not necessarily the impact that we think we're having or that we want to be having. So the thing that keeps us going, the thing that keeps us centred, the thing that keeps us grounded is a set of values and a commitment to actually living those values. So something to, I think Damien talked about having a strong sense of ethics, and I think he talked about having integrity. So I wanted to introduce the idea that integrity is actually a personality structure that enables people to live out their values in every moment of every day. In one moment, it's about, am I being congruent or authentic? But over time, it's about, you know, do I have integrity? Okay. The it depends on a capacity for self-reflection, for being willing to learn about our own blind spots. It depends on my willingness to actually take responsibility for the communication that I enact. Yeah? But what you feel, think, and do because of what I say and how I say it. Now, how you receive it and what you do with that is your responsibility. Nonetheless, it is my responsibility as well. So successful communication lives in the communicator. The receiver is part of the environment that a successful communicator operates in. So I say something to you and you hit the roof. Well, you know, it would be really nice to actually blame you. Because really, what did I say? What did I do? You know, the reality is that true communication is the response I get. If you hit the roof, there was something I said. My tone of voice, my body language, the words that I used, my timing, my sensitivity to something. Yeah, that is my responsibility, and I actually need to think about that. And after I've thought about it, I need to come and apologise to you and see if we can actually clean it up. Because if I don't, you will become increasingly wary of conversations with me, and they will become increasingly wary of telling me stuff that you think I don't want to know. Yeah? Now, there are a lot of people for whom the ability to tell the truth is optional. It's contextual. Yeah? Sometimes I'll tell the truth. When it gets really, really urgent, I'll give the bad news. But really, look along the way, well, you know, maybe I'm on my way to pick up my sick child from daycare. I'll have that conversation with you later. Or I'm really frazzled. I'm really up under the pump. I've got to get this stuff out. I'll have that conversation with you later. Or, you know, I saw something and I'm actually not quite sure that what I saw was what I think I saw. You know, look, I'll wait till it comes up again and I'll have that conversation with you later. Now, the reality is later never happens. It's my way of lying to myself about the fact that I'm actually walking past a responsibility that I have. Yeah? And an accumulation of that sort of behaviour allows a crisis or a dire situation to occur down the track. One last slide, I think. Okay. Yeah, so this is the last slide. So I'll just leave you with the thought that, you know, you can read every single management leadership textbook under the sun and come away with the 10 million and three things that you need to be doing in order to be successful. Think about the fact that there are three. An organisation and a person needs a vision. There's an organisation vision coheres people. Yeah. It brings people together. It gives them a sense that something's happening, that things are possible. You need a personal vision to turn your dreams into reality, and it gets you out of bed when things go south. Most organisations have a vision. They get that bit right. Work needs to be fun. Now, I'm not talking about laughing and joking and drinks on a Friday afternoon. There's a lot of time when laughter actually covers up something dire. I'm talking about fun as the sense of when your creativity is engaged. Yeah? So you need, and this varies for each person, yeah? You need to have the right degree of autonomy, the right degree of variety or challenge, the right degree of learning. Yeah? What's too much for me can be too little for you and vice versa, but you need to be able to talk about it. Now, I also need to have mutual support and respect in my organisation. You can't have too much of it. I need to have meaningful work. If you want people to do a good job, you need to give them a good job. You need to give them a job that's good to do. Yeah? And I need to have a desirable future. If I don't have a desirable future in this organisation, why am I here? Now, organisations are actually getting better at structuring work that engages people, at getting the fit between the person and the work right, and at giving people responsibility for actually making sure that the fit is right for them. The thing that organisations don't do is actually have a clean fight. Yeah? I need to know who you are. I need to know what you think, what you feel. I need to know what impact I'm having on you. I need to know who you are as a person if I'm going to actually follow you into uncharted waters. Yeah? The biggest fight you're ever going to have in an organisation is not with your boss, not with your colleagues, not with the psychopath in the corner office, you know, not with the market, not with the customer who just will not buy from you. It's the fight you have with yourself that a lot of the time you don't even know about. That determines whether you open your mouth and what comes out. And that's where real leadership sits, inside that willingness to actually engage with yourself and put it out there. Okay, I'm done. How do I turn this off?
Well, I might kick off with a question for you, Peter. What happened next?
we got home in one piece. But we had a bunch of trainees on board, you know, 18-year-old young men, all men in the British Submarine Service. One of them was called Jonesy. And the first question he asked when he got on board was, will we be home for Christmas? Not an unreasonable question, and the answer was yes. But, of course, the other sailors saw this as a weakness and just gave him untold hassle about getting home for Christmas. Every time he appeared in the mess queue or something, someone would make some crack about Santa Claus or, you know, which Christmas, and so it went on and on and on. Anyway, he was one of the 20 pairs of eyes that I sort of settled on as I looked around the control room. And it just occurred to me to say, don't worry, Jonesy, we'll be home for Christmas. And that sort of bit of humour that really plugged into part of the ongoing culture in the boat worked a treat. Everyone sort of chuckled, they were relaxed, there was a bit of sort of follow-up banter went on. Time suddenly started passing much more quickly. And the next time we really focused on what was going on, the rate of descent had decreased. And in fact, we were always going to win. We didn't know that at the time, of course, but inertia in a 5,000-ton submarine takes a bit of time to shift it. We were always going to win. And it was just really a case of filling that vacuum with a bit of leadership so that the troops felt a bit happier again and could refocus on their tasks. So the answer was I used a bit of humour, and I don't know why it came to me like that. There might have been 100,000 other things that anyone could have said that would have worked just as well or perhaps even better. But anyway, and then we got ourselves sorted out, got the reactor back, carried on the patrol, got home, got a bollocking for what we'd done, but a few of my people got medals as well. So that was really good.
It's easy to prepare for the crisis situation now because of what we've just seen, particularly, you know, what we've heard from you, Warwick. How do we go about it in five years' time? How do we maintain the rage? Perhaps, Warwick, you'd like to just start, kick off.
Well, I think you have to have people in the organisation who have been through it and can tell people the war story, what happened. And because if you have nobody who's been through something, it's difficult to maintain that rage. So if you have some people around who have been through a crisis, then certainly it's you can point to what happened, and it can happen to here too. You know, I think it's just it just shows a bit of reality, I think.
I think this is a real challenge for leadership, and when things are going really well, we don't want around us people who are always sniping at the business model. You know, it's going really well. we know what the future is. We just open six more of these and it multiplies our profit by 60. We don't want people around us saying, ah, but, you know, what happens? What about this black swan and so on? The simple fact is I think we must have them. We must keep around us people who are irritating when things are going really well. And that would be one of my maxims for building my team.
Yeah, it's interesting. In a seminar, or at least a community session we had recently around liquidity, one of the slides that was put up there were various newspaper headlines around the liquidity crisis that was happening at the time. And then he put up the dates, and they were all sort of 1990. And yet that was exactly what, or one of the big causes of the GFC. What's the, you know, you touched on it somewhat, Warwick, about having people who have been there, done that. I guess I'd like to sort of open the question as to the value of diversity and a range of experiences and skill sets within a team.
Well, the short answer is yes. What can happen, though, is if people are irritated by each other and they stop listening to each other and they stop asking questions and they stop being curious, then you can have as diverse a group as possible. If you don't actually keep that curiosity going, then it won't serve you.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges we have when we're in organisations that grow their own leaders, and certainly the military would be one of those. I don't know about yours, but if you have organisations where most of the CEOs come from the financial services area, then I guess you'd be in the same category. One of the problems with that is people tend to think the same, and we have a tendency, of course, to attract around us people who think the same as us. And I think making sure that we have people who are capable of thinking differently, and then I talked about them being irritating before, but seeing that for what it is, and then using that as a point of leverage, is really important.
The other thought that I have is that the research indicates that heterogeneous groups outperform homogeneous groups. That's good up to a point. After about 3 months, though, when people have really come together, they start to hold back. Yeah? They start to not say things because the bonding and the social norms start to coalesce. And the advantages that you may have gained initially by the heterogeneity of your group disappear. Yeah. So again, group process and group dynamics to keep the curiosity alive is really important.
As a group, actuaries, we like to get it right. We don't like to tolerate mistakes. How is it best to tolerate mistakes, but at the same time punish stupidity or blatant bad habits?
One of the ways in which I work is to actually use language. Language is a form of behaviour. Yeah? It's one of the ways in which we access the mental models that people have about how the world works. Now, one of the things that but does is totally negate everything that's come before that. Yeah. So the person who asks this question has absolutely no interest in tolerating mistakes. The person who asks this question is actually interested in punishing stupidity or blatant bad behaviour. it's actually a really complex question to say, how do I curb my irritation? And how do I actually put that to one side so that we can think together about what you learnt and what you did? And what were the conditions that led to that? So that next time you'll make a different mistake. You know, there's a difference between blame and responsibility. Yeah, they're very, very different. Yes, I made a mistake, and yes, I'm responsible. But if you blame me for that, then I will never, ever learn. And you blaming me for the mistake that I made might make you feel better in the short term, but the long-term consequences are I get shut down, I don't learn, I'll probably repeat that mistake. And I'll probably do lots of others as well.
I think there's a big difference between perhaps tolerating mistakes isn't quite the right term, but encouraging people to learn from mistakes, encouraging people to push the limits and inevitably, therefore, make occasional mistakes and learn from them. There's a difference between that and allowing someone to be blatantly stupid. And I don't think any CEO would ever advocate that, and it's certainly not what we mean. If someone is stupid, then you know they've got to be dealt with. But I think what we're trying to avoid is the culture in which people won't push the limits, won't try hard, won't give of their best because they're afraid of making a mistake. We had this problem in the Australian fleet a few years ago, and we looked around to what tended to happen if someone ran their ship aground, they were out of the Navy. That was it, finished. Now, you know, we want these guys to push hard. We want them to take risks, managed risks, but we want them to get used to the stress of operating out of their comfort zones, because that's how you win battles if you have to go to war. That's what the taxpayers were investing in. But we had turned out a very risk-averse fleet. So we waited for someone to make a mistake that we thought was an understandable mistake, and we didn't have to wait long, and we then made absolutely sure that from the highest level we treated that young commanding officer properly, and we said to the whole fleet, look, you know, this guy was pushing it hard, he pushed it just a bit too hard, and it was a submariner, of course it always is, he ran his submarine into the bottom, didn't do too much damage fortunately, and that guy is now a senior officer in the Navy, and he learned a tremendous amount from that. And we also demonstrated that we do want people to push hard, and we are not going to beat them up if they make an understandable mistake. We wouldn't want them to make too many or make the same mistake twice, but I think that's the sort of culture that Colin's talking about.
I think that the way that I've done it in the past is to keep people around who have made just normal average mistakes and discuss them in the team environment, but to quickly get rid of people who have made the stupid mistakes. I think that reinforces the message to the remaining people that average mistakes are sort of tolerated, but the stupid ones are quickly punished.
Warwick, I might ask the next question of you. Given all the conflict, swearing and stress that you described, what in your view is the medium impact on AIG culture of that conflict and damage to the people?
AIG culture is not a risk aware culture. It was get revenue, get expenses, get profit. So it didn't have a risk element to the culture as far as I could observe it. Short answer on the damage it did, basically, I believe that almost everybody who was in head office at that time has been exited as part of transition, you know, to the new owner, MetLife. And I think it's just a fact that I guess the old adage in Japan is that you can outlast your foe if you wait long enough. I guess that says it all for me.
Given the time, we'll just have time for one last question. In a crisis, how is it best to balance the need for information analysis and action?
I can't begin to imagine how many requests we got from New York about what's your cash level, what's your exposure to this security, what's your exposure to that security. It was unbelievable, and yet we had to have a team working on all the things that we needed to do in order to keep the business alive and working. And at times we told them to get lost. They didn't appreciate that, but they said, we just told them, look, the business comes first, we have to survive. We'll get you information as soon as we can, but you have to wait. And at the end of the day, they accepted that, but it was a tough call to make to say that to them.
I think this is, there's a constant trade-off in this. I mean, in the scenario that I went through with you, everyone was scared. They had no idea of, well, none of us had any idea what was going to happen. By the time the 20 pairs of eyes turned, we had a bit too much time on our hands. People were starting to think about just how bad life could get. It was almost winter in Siberia, so it wasn't a nice prospect. But I think getting data and analysing it to assist decision making is clearly a good thing to do. But there comes a time when all these rules break down, and when, as a leader, one's dealing with emotions and people's fears and their guilt and all this sort of stuff, when it's gut feel. Now, that's a pretty unsatisfactory answer, I think, for you guys. But my sense is that that's what it was. There comes a time when you've just got to make a stab at it and work with the emotions as they present to you. And that is more important sometimes than doing the analysis, because it's the people who want some response from you. It's the people who want to be touched by the leader. And that's all about emotions, and it's all about the gut feel of the leader.
I just want to add to that, I mean, you talked a lot about building models and getting the metrics right. Every single metric that you have about how your organisation is doing is a lag indicator. Yeah? It does not give you real-time data. The only real-time data you have is your gut feel, your capacity to read the environment, to read the person, to read the room, to gauge the climate now. And that is data that you need to cultivate assiduously if you're going to manage the risk in your organisation.
Well, I've certainly found it particularly insightful both today and the time that I've spent with our three guests just preparing for today. There's a lot I'd like to follow up with them and talk further, but unfortunately time doesn't permit. But some of the things that particularly stood out to me was, I guess, particularly that last point around the fact that, we as actuaries, we love to have data, we love to sort of have all the answers, but I guess in a real crisis, probably one of the keys is this leadership and the ability to actually move forward without all the answers. And I think, interestingly enough, a lot of that, from what I understand you to say, Colleen, really comes down to very much the personal values and strengths. I'd certainly be quite interested in learning more, but as I say, time doesn't permit. Would everyone please thank our three guests for their great insights.